We are talking today with Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill is director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation. He is the former senior analyst and co-founder of the Center for Voting and Democracy, Fair Vote. He was campaign manager in San Francisco for the successful effort that passed instant runoff voting for electing local offices, and was one of the organizers of successful efforts to pass public financing of elections for local campaigns. He has written numerous articles and commentaries that have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, and the Houston Chronicle. And he is author of several books, including Whose Vote Counts?, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. And here to talk about his new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Stephen, thanks for spending time with us today.
Mike, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Let's begin and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy?
Well, the motivation was twofold, really. Giving a lot of talks around the United States about democracy and really the breakdown of our democracy, and wanting to, in a sense, I mean, so many things are happening that just to catalog them. So, I would hear from a lot of people, you know, it's just so depressing. There's just so many things going on. I mean, what do we do? And so the book is very solution oriented. So, hence 10 steps to repair American democracy. Wanting to come up with the solutions that people could read about and get some sense of a direction of what are the most important reforms. Cause that's the other thing I would often hear from people is, you know, there's so many different political reforms, campaign finance reform, media reform, instant runoff voting, voting equipment, election administration, that's in a lot of people's concern right now. How do I know which ones are most important? So the book was sort of came out of those need-driven questions and trying to give a sense of here's the most important reforms, I believe, and then giving an overview showing really cataloging where our democracy is at this point in the early 21st century, which the point of view of the book is that our democracy has been working about as well as the levees around New Orleans, and we've got to take some major strides here to really make it work.
All right, so I'm hoping we can actually go through the 10 different fixes that you've come up with. And do you present those in any hierarchical order in terms of importance, or are they all kind of equally important?
There's no particular order except that I sort of, it's a mix of what I know people are most concerned about. So, for instance, the first step is voting equipment and election administration, which many people are very concerned about, justifiably so. If you can't be certain that the ballots are being counted correctly, it kind of undermines the very basis for your democracy. And then the other 10 steps are sort of a mix of which ones I thought are most important and which ones are being talked about today, like campaign finance reform, and that gets a lot of attention. But then other reforms that actually are equally important but don't get as much attention just because there's so many things to pay attention to with a war going on and what have you.
So the first chapter you have is Secure the Vote. Tell us about that.
This was the chapter where what I tried to do was really sift through a lot of what's being written about this, because there's a whole lot of information, and it's become almost difficult for many people to separate fact from fiction and to figure, really assess, what is the nature of voting equipment and election administration in the United States, and where should we be putting our attention in terms of making it work better. So, you know, I looked at Ohio in 2004 and looked at the 2000 presidential election, and no question, there were many disturbing things that went on in those elections. And, you know, the long lines, 7, 8, 9 hours to vote, voting equipment, giving votes to the wrong candidate, poll workers asking for voter IDs, even though it was it's not legal to do so. You know, all sorts of things. Probably a lot of your listeners are very familiar with the litany of things that have been going on. And, you know, what I concluded was that there wasn't really a smoking gun. I mean, in the sense of, like, we have a lot of allegations, we have a lot of evidence, but we didn't have solid proof that something had actually occurred fraudulently to steal the election. But on the other hand, it's also true that for the second presidential election in a row, we gave an election for the most powerful elective office in the world, and we couldn't say with 100% certainty that the correct candidate won. And that in itself is an extremely indicting statement that, you know, you can't assert that the correct candidate won. And that, in my mind, I mean, it almost became like, you know, what's the point of trying to prove there was fraud? We know enough stuff broke down and hasn't necessarily been fixed, so that for the 2008 election, we still have the same vulnerabilities that we've got to get our act together to make it work. And so then the question for me became, more importantly, what do we do to make our elections work? I was sort of looking forward rather than still looking behind. I understand people that want to still go back and try and review what happened and whether there was fraud or not, but you know, I was thinking, you know, we've got to be ready for 2008 at this point, because I'll tell you, our last two presidential elections have come down to two states, Ohio and Florida, and we have every indication here in 2006 that the 2008 election is also going to come down to Ohio and Florida. So I sort of took the view, what can we do to get ready for 2008 and even for this upcoming November election? Because, you know, there's only a handful of seats that are up for grabs that are contested. So it's sort of ironic that because so many of our seats and our elections are not competitive, it's both narrowed the field in terms of the races we have to watch to make sure that they aren't stolen or determined by fraudulent means, but it also means it's narrowed the field for those who are maybe thinking about trying to change outcomes through fraudulent means. It's really raised the stakes in terms of the elections in Ohio and Florida and the, you know, 35 congressional House seats that are up for grabs in this November elections. And so we better be ready for those if we really want to make sure that our elections are not stolen.
So what specific fixes do you see for sticking with that subject?
Well, you know, here's the recommendations that I came up with. First is that we have to have a system that ensures that we have impartial election officials. You know, beyond the issue of voting equipment and voter verified paper trails and the things that are getting most of the attention right now, we have to really understand what happened in the 2000 presidential elections, where you had the secretaries of state of various states serving as the co-chair of the George Bush reelection campaign. You had the secretary of state of Missouri, who was co-chair of the George Bush reelection campaign, who was also running for governor. He was overseeing an election in which he was running for governor, and he won. And, you know, it's actually unfortunately works both sides of the aisle. The Secretary of State of West Virginia, a Democrat, was overseeing the election in which he ran for governor, and he won. So, you know, we had Mexican election observers here in the 2004 presidential election. They said, this just looks like the old PRI to us. You know, that was the party in Mexico that won elections fraudulently for 70 years by having control of the electoral process. And then in addition to that, when you have the CEO of Diebold, Walden O'Dell, saying we're going to deliver the state of Ohio to the president while his company is seeking millions of dollars in contracts, you have ties between the other vendors and certain parts of the Republican Party, you have the federal testing laboratories that test voting equipment, the independent testing authorities, as they're called, ITAs, and two of them give tens of thousands of dollars to the Republican Party. So that told me that the issue is much more complex than simply what voting equipment are we using and what, whether we have a voter verified paper trail. I mean, people forget that we have a long history in the United States of elections being stolen when we were using paper ballots and pens, you know, ballot boxes being stuffed and ballot boxes disappearing. And so what that told me at the top of the list really is that if the election officials themselves are compromised, it doesn't matter what technology you're using, you're going to be in trouble. And so we have to start passing laws to make election administration truly nonpartisan, and also to make the election administrators at the county level, which is where most elections are actually run on the day-to-day basis, to make sure that they're professional and they're competent. The example I use, and there's numerous examples like this across the United States, in California, the election administrator of one large county, he started behind the desk answering phones, entry-level position. He'd never worked in elections before. 3 years later, he was director of the department just through attrition, people leaving. And so it's sort of like they turned to him, do you want to do it? Prior to answering phones in the Department of Elections, he was writing product descriptions for a seafood company. These are the types of people that tend to get involved in elections. They just kind of drift into it because, oh, well, I'll give that a shot. You know, it's not like these are highly trained, professional people who are familiar with technology, familiar with computers, familiar with databases, which is very much about elections today. So that told me that we need to professionalize this entire occupation. That, I mean, you can go to school today to become a political consultant. You can go to a university and you learn about polls and focus groups and how to take the message and for your candidate and put it out there to the voters. So if you can go to school, learn how to be a political consultant, why shouldn't you be required to go to school to learn how to run elections? And that's what they do in other democracies. They actually have, it's more of a profession. It's more of a civil service position. So these things become extremely important, and yet, you know, they're kind of the nitty-gritty that don't quite capture the headlines and don't quite fire the imaginations of people like Diebold voting equipment, the idea that you can change the software and the equipment and steal an election and not be detected, which is extremely important also to keep in mind. But my point is that the only reason that is even allowed to exist, you know, that we can have this crummy voting equipment, is because the election administrative infrastructure is itself sagging. It's like, you know, a bridge going across the river that's creaking and groaning and is, you know, in various stages of collapse. And people are just driving across this bridge blithely as if there's, you know, no problem. And so the election administration itself is really, in my view, even more important than the voting equipment, because it's the overall structure that determines these sorts of things. So that means we need to have impartial election officials, as I said. We need to have professionalization of the occupation. We need to have a National Elections Commission, which is what most established democracies have, that provides uniform standards. So you don't have different states, different counties treating provisional ballots differently. You don't have different standards for how to test the voting equipment. You don't have the election administrators who are making decisions about how to treat ballots. You know, one county does it one way, another county does it another way. Overseas voters are treated differently by different counties and different election administrators. I mean, I sometimes liken it to, what if our airports and our airlines were, you know, dealt with county by county or even state by state, and each time you flew to a different state, there was a whole different set of standards and you know, or even the highways that we have. Each time you went to a different state, they had a whole different type of highway that it was, you know, worked differently on your tires or something. I mean, we recognize that certain times it just makes sense to have national standards and have a national system, and that's what we need to have, something like that in the United States and which other democracies already have, and it just makes a whole lot of sense when it comes to election administration. So these are the types of things that I go into in the first step. The holy grail, in my view, of what we need to do about election administration is what I call public interest voting equipment. Instead of leaving the purchase of voting equipment up to county election administrators, as who I said are not highly trained, don't understand computers very well, and they're buying it from these shadowy vendors, these, you know, corporations who have ties to all sorts of, you know, different parts of the Republican Party. What we need is public interest voting equipment, where the government itself comes up with the voting equipment, and it's all part of an open and secure process, open source software, where the code is not proprietary, owned by these shadowy vendors that, you know, they don't want people to look at it. They keep it in escrow. Okay, that's good. But, you know, then like we've seen with Diebold, they insert patches that they don't necessarily put back into the escrow. They don't even get those patches tested. This is just nuts. And other countries, even countries like Brazil and India, have pioneered this public interest voting equipment, where the government itself works with this private sector to come up with the voting equipment, the software, and the government controls the code. The government controls the process. It's done in an open process with public hearings and all sorts of things where it's tested adequately. That really cleans up the process. So this is, in my view, is the direction that we need to go when it comes to public administration of our elections. And, you know, it's quite a bit more of a project than simply a voter-verified paper trail, which a lot of people have put their hope and faith in, and which I do say is a good thing to have. But it's the beginning of what we need to do to clean up our elections, not the end by any means.
So what do you see as a realistic timeline to implement the proposed, I was using the word fix, but since that has multiple connotations, the proposed repairs that you're putting out there?
Well, different things can happen at different times. So in terms of requiring, for example, what they call a manual recount after each election, a certain percentage of precincts that are randomly selected, and then you hand count those ballots in those precincts and you compare it to the machine count. That can happen. I mean, any person living in any county right now can go to their county election administrator, go to their local city council, what have you, and get a law passed if you need to, if you can't get the agreement of the county election administrator to just do that. You know, we just saw recently in Ohio where there was a discrepancy, and this was just discovered because they didn't let the data out until just recently. There was this discrepancy between the books that you sign in with, you know, when you go in to vote. You sign in a book, and the number of people sign in to that book per precinct had better match the number of people who voted in that precinct, or you've got a big problem on your hands. And, you know, certain states, certain counties are much better at doing that kind of reconciliation with their books. Others, like in Ohio, I mean, here we are a couple of years after the presidential election, and they're just now getting around to letting these books be public so that, you know, activists could go in there and compare them and finding, wow, there's a discrepancy. That's very disturbing. So there are little things that if people pay attention to, I mean, a lot of times we get focused on the big picture, and we want to fix everything right away. And unfortunately, the problems are so vast that we're not going to fix them right away. But if we're smart and we you know, spend the time studying the problem and then finding the smaller things that actually are bite-sized, but they can make a dramatic difference, like these sorts of things, we can get those changed right away. In the meantime, keep educating people about these more important issues, like passing laws to make sure the election administrators are fair and impartial and are not affiliated with any of the political parties, and certainly aren't serving as co-chairs of the re-election campaigns of any candidates whatsoever. And certainly the people who are running our elections cannot themselves be running for another office. I mean, these are just no-brainers. Those may take a little bit more time, but, you know, when you put them forward to the public says, yeah, that just makes sense. It's not like there's a lot of controversy around that. It's just that no one has really bothered to try and draft laws along these lines.
And are these changes, are they something that communities can do on a local level, or are they statewide, or is it national? Or
many of them are county-level regulations that can be passed. Things like manual tallies. I mean, you can just get your election administrator to agree to do some sort of sampling of precincts after the election and make sure it's enough. I mean, you know, some places do this already, but they only sample 1% of precincts. It's not enough. You have to do more like 5% to 10% to really make it meaningful. So get them to just agree to do that and to make it a public process so that people can observe while they're doing it. There's a whole range of things that can be done at the local county level, and then others need to be done at the state level, and then a few that are going to take federal action, but that's going to take some time.
All right. Let's move on to your second proposal, expand voter participation.
The idea behind this step was that in a whole range of ways, we make it difficult for people to vote. And the net result of this is that we have 60 million eligible voters in the United States who are not registered. And actually, those 60 million eligible voters tend to be young people, poor people, minorities. So it skews the electorate by making the electorate less like the people who live in our country. It makes the electorate overwhelmingly whiter and wealthier than those who live in our country. In fact, in California, the Public Policy Institute of California just came out with very interesting studies showing the really quite sizable gap between the electorate in California, those who vote, and the population of California, and how their opinions differ on very important issues like Proposition 13, you know, property taxes, and whether money should go towards more services for people and these sorts of things, whether it should go towards lowering costs of education. So the fact that we have so many people who are not on the rolls has huge ramifications for our democracy and for policy. And then in addition to that, you have situations like the residents of the District of Columbia, our nation's capital, do not have the right to vote for a member of Congress. We're the only capital in the world that I'm aware of where the residents of a nation's capital do not have the right to elect a member to their national legislature. People who live in District Columbia do not vote for a member of the House of Representatives nor for a member to the United States Senate. You know, and in fact, they have the District of Columbia license plate says, you know, no taxation without representation because it's just, again, another one of these. In America, there's so many strange things that occur that just defy logic, and yet they exist. And sometimes you just can't even understand why. And many other people around the world increasingly look at the United States and just shake their heads and say, I just don't understand it. And having lived here all my life, there are many things like this that I shake my head and also say, I just don't understand why in our nation's capital we have 600,000 people who live there, they pay taxes there, and they don't have the right to vote for a member to the House of Representatives. So also we, you know, should we have a national holiday for voting or weekend voting? These are the types of things, these enfranchisement issues that I take up, and also the level of, level of intimidation that's going on, a reoccurrence that we're seeing in various parts of the country where particularly minority voters are being intimidated again, or, you know, things are being mailed to them to try and get them to not vote and these sorts of things. So perhaps the reform that I, in that particular step that I think is the most important, is what is known as universal voter registration. With universal voter registration, instead of filling out all these forms, and if you move, you've got to fill out another form, and you know all these sorts of things, which is how we do it in the United States. Most established democracies have universal voter registration where when you turn 18 and you're now eligible to vote, you are automatically registered to vote. You know, you get something in the mail saying congratulations, you're now registered, here's where you vote, end of story. In fact, it's rather ironic that Iraq, when it had its first election, had a higher percentage of adults registered to vote than we have here in the United States because they had universal voter registration where the government proactively was seeking out people and registering them to vote because it was a different value there of it's important to get people on the rolls and get them voting. Here in the United States, we have apparently, at least among certain people, a very different value of we only want people like myself voting. Or, you know, you hear all the time, well, some people are just too dumb to vote. It's rather astounding. I mean, if we applied that standard, we'd all have our different opinions on who's too dumb to vote. And if we all got to strike the people we wanted from voting who are too dumb, we might have even fewer people voting in the United States than we have even now. Peremptory challenges like they have in court or something like this, it would be quite amusing, I suppose. So the point is with universal voter registration is you automatically register people to vote. And if we were to do that in the United States, that 60 million people who are eligible to vote who are not on the rolls would be automatically added to the rolls. We could do this rather easily by using Department of Motor Vehicles databases. We have lots of people who have a driver's license, but they're not registered to vote. You compare that to the statewide voter database, which all states are required to come up with now, and you just see who's on the Department of Motor Vehicle database that's not in the statewide voter database. Well, you add them to the voter rolls. You send them something in the mail saying, congratulations, you've just been added to the voter rolls, and here's where you vote. You know, it's so easy to do, and yet we don't do it, and that it really shows that there's something there in terms of American values that have to be challenged. And so, you know, I think universal voter registration, by starting that conversation and talking to party leaders about, you know, why shouldn't everyone who's eligible to vote just be simply added to the rolls? It's going to start a very important conversation that will, I think, reveal a lot about American values that can then be put out more out into the light of day where they need to be to really show that we have to start valuing the right to vote and democracy much more than we do today.
Do you think that would address the problem of, for instance, here in Washington State, on our last election for our governor, there was a big to-do about people registering improperly, who were registered improperly, dead people who had been registered, things like that. Would that solve that problem?
It sure would, because what happens now with our voter registration is that they often are tied to – voter registration is tied to registration drives around certain elections. And you see all sorts of flagrant abuses that go on at that time as each side tries to get their people on the rolls and to the polls and, you know, and keep the other side off. So we saw things in the 2004 presidential election, like in Nevada, where an organization was out there registering people to vote, collecting voter registration cards, and suddenly someone found a whole bunch of these voter registration cards in the garbage. And they looked at them, and they turned out to be all Democratic Party registrants. Turned out that this organization was a front group for the Republican Party that was collecting all these, and then you have a lot of people out there who are Democrats thinking they're registered to vote, but they're not. So on election day, when they show up, they're told, sorry, you can't vote, and they're completely disenfranchised. And, you know, there have been some isolated incidents of dead people being registered to vote, though I think those sorts of things are much overhyped by certain, you know, forces who have another agenda about who to keep on voting on election day and who to keep out of the voter's booth. That's really what it's about. So with universal voter registration, there's no longer a dispute about who is and who is not registered because just everybody is. It becomes the norm. And it just, again, it engenders a whole different attitude about what our democracy is about, is that everybody is registered to vote. You know, there aren't these questions anymore about some people are too dumb or some people. I've had people tell me only people who own a house or own property should be able to vote. And, you know, we've got to get past that. This is the 21st century, for heaven's sakes. And I think in some ways, by how we do these voter registration laws, it perpetuates these kind of 18th century mentalities. So by just passing universal voter registration, I mean, there are 8 states right now where the Democratic Party controls both houses of the state legislature and the governor's office, and they could pass universal voter registration in those 8 states. Washington State happens to be one of them. So I think people asking the leaders of the Democratic Party in Washington State, why don't you just have universal voter registration and just add everybody to the rolls? Let's lead the nation on these kinds of things. I think that's would be a very interesting conversation to begin here in Washington State.
All right, moving along. Increase voter choice with instant runoff voting.
Instant runoff voting is a method, electoral system, that offers a lot to the United States and to voters in the United States because instead of just picking a candidate like you do now, who you may or may not like, but you pick your lesser of two evils candidate, you get to rank a first choice, a second choice, and a third choice. And if your first choice can't win, your vote goes to your second choice as your runoff choice. It's like your backup choice or your insurance choice sometimes, as I call it. And if we had used this system, for example, in the 2000 presidential election, the 100,000 Ralph Nader voters would have had the option of ranking a second choice. And there's no question that tens of thousands of them would have ranked Al Gore as their second choice. Gore would have been the recipient of all these runoff votes. He would have won Florida and the presidency. So it's a good example of how just the change in an electoral system can make a big difference in terms of making sure that the winners are the ones preferred by the most voters. Now, this is not necessarily a partisan reform. In 1992, the Ross Perot supporters would have had the option of ranking a second choice. Perhaps they would have picked George Herbert Walker Bush over Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton won the presidential election in 1992 with only 43% of the popular vote. So, you know, instant runoff voting is about electing our office holders with a majority of the vote, but getting it over in one election. Because if the winner does not have a majority, you know, and they're winning with 43% of the vote or 37% of the vote, is the, you know, a couple of governors have won elections with 37%. The mayor of Albuquerque, the last 3 elections in a row, has had less than 30% of the vote. You can't be certain that the correct candidate is winning. The fact is, there may be a candidate in that race that's preferred by more voters in that race, but because of, you know, too many candidates running, 6-7 candidates running, and split votes among candidates who come from like-minded points of view, and so liberals and progressives are splitting their vote among, you know, 2 or 3 candidates, you end up with these very odd results where you can't be certain that the correct candidate is winning. So instant runoff voting is really about freeing up you, the voter, to be sure that you can vote for the candidate you like and not have to shoot yourself in the foot by helping to elect a candidate you like the least. It really liberates voters to vote for your favorite candidates. So it's being used now, and it's one of these new reforms that has only been talked about for the last few years, but now it's We're using it in San Francisco. We'll have our third election this November using instant runoff voting. Berkeley will begin using it soon. Burlington, Vermont had their first mayoral election just this past spring using instant runoff voting. Tacoma Park, Maryland also will have its first election next year using instant runoff voting. It's on the ballot in four different places in the United States this November. Those four places being Oakland, California, Davis, California, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then right here in Washington State, Pierce County has Amendment 3, which is going to implement instant runoff voting for county offices in Pierce County. It's an exciting campaign, and there's a website, amendment3.com, that's 3-T-H-R-E-E.com, that your listeners might want to check out, because I think it might be something that's good for King County and for Washington State in general, because it answers a real need that you've had here in Washington State, where you've had the blanket primary. It was it was very popular among Washington voters, and we had the same situation in California. We had the blanket primary. It went through the same legal problems. And then voters in Washington State voted for the top two primary. That also was sued by the political parties, went to the courts. The courts similarly said, you can't force parties to use this kind of primary system. I mean, the courts ruled that a party's selection of their candidates is a right of free association. It's basically they're saying a party's primary is a private affair. So there's an interesting question here. Well, if it's their private affair, why do the taxpayers have to pay for it? And so what Amendment 3 in Pierce County is doing is it's getting rid of the party primary. And it's going to have one election in November with instant runoff voting. And then the parties come up with their own nominating procedure to, you know, deliver their candidates to that November election. So it's going to give Pierce County voters, and if it was used for the entire state of Washington, it would give Washington State voters the freedom of choice they had in the blanket primary, where you can rank a Democrat first if you want, a Green Party candidate second, a Republican third. You're not restricted in that way. But it's going to do it by getting rid of the pick-a-party primary, as it's called here, and having the any-choice, any-candidate instant runoff voting election. So I think it's exciting.
You were involved in getting IRV brought to San Francisco, is that correct?
Yeah, I ran the campaign for instant runoff voting, both to get it on the ballot, and then once it was on the ballot, the electoral campaign to pass it, which we passed in 2002. We had our first election in 2004, and, you know, implementing it and the issues of voting equipment were really, I learned more about the vendors and the voting equipment during that whole time trying to implement instant runoff voting and just seeing how really broken our election administration regime is. And that's where I really cut my teeth on just seeing it all. But yes, I ran that campaign in San Francisco.
And you're looking at your third election using that. Have you seen an increase in voter participation since IRV came about?
We certainly have, though let's be clear on why it is. It's not like voters are just so thrilled to be able to rank their candidates. It's just like, wow, this is thrilling. I'm going to go vote. It's because we were having our final election in December in a runoff election where voter turnout would plummet. It would often drop by up to 40% of voters who were coming out. So now we're getting the election over in November, when voter turnout tends to be much higher. We just had an election in 2005 where, compared to the runoff that was finished in November with instant runoff voting, compared to a December runoff, we had about 120,000 more voters. Voter turnout increased about almost 300% over what it would have been in a December runoff. And here's the important point as well, is that, you know, when voter turnout is that low, it's not like it's low across the board. Certain communities are more negatively impacted, and whether it's San Francisco or Seattle or Oakland or wherever, or any of these urban areas. And typically, it's minorities who are not turning out for these two election cycles, whether it's a primary general election or a November election, December runoff. And so we saw a 400% increase in the six most minority neighborhoods in San Francisco, where voters were now having a say in who their elected representatives were going to be because we got the election over in November. So that's really the key part, and that's what they're going to be doing in Pierce County, is one election in November using instant runoff voting and getting rid of these low turnout. I mean, you just had a primary election here in Washington, and the voter turnout was extremely low. There was very little competition. Some of the quite a few number of races on the state level were not even contested. And on top of that, you had a very confusing ballot that caused certain counties to have an invalid ballot rate of anywhere from 11% to 20%. So, you know, I mean, what is the point of this primary election? And in fact, it's undermining our democracy. It's not the case that, you know, the more elections, the merrier. Sometimes, you know, there's too many elections and we can do it smarter and more efficiently. And that's what this instant runoff voting does. And that's what we're doing in San Francisco.
We're talking with Stephen Hill. He is author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. And one of your next steps is scrap winner-take-all elections. Talk about that.
Well, the idea behind scrapping winner-take-all elections is what winner-take-all elections means is that we elect our legislative elections using one seat at a time. And the highest vote getter wins. They gain, you know, voters who voted for that highest vote getter gains a representative. Everyone else basically goes unrepresented. And we see the result of this because, you know, we live in this era of what they call red versus blue America, where we have these, most of our legislative districts are one-party strongholds. They're either strongly Republican or strongly Democrat. The upcoming November election, out of 435 House seats that are being contested, we can tell you right now who's going to win 400 of them. And it's become this way more than it used to be. Now, part of that reason is because of the redistricting process and how the incumbents manipulate the redistricting process. But actually, the more we've been studying this, we're starting to realize that there's something even more fundamental at work. And that is that people have been sort of self-selecting themselves into living in these partisan residential enclaves to the point where the urban areas have become increasingly liberal, increasingly blue, increasingly Democratic. The rural areas have become increasingly conservative and red Republican. And so it becomes really difficult to draw competitive districts, even if you have an independent redistricting commission using the best of standards to do that. So a state like Washington, where the Democrats dominate Western Washington, Republicans dominate Eastern Washington outside of perhaps the Spokane area, unless you're going to draw districts that go east-west across the Cascade Mountains, and, you know, kind of like teeth of a fork or something like this going east-west, it's really difficult to draw competitive districts in Washington state, it turns out. And this is true of many other states. California, where I live, it's very similar. I mean, you can't draw a district that's competitive in the San Francisco Bay Area unless you're going to start it in downtown San Francisco, draw it across the bay over into Contra Costa County, which is the more conservative parts of the bay. These kind of spokes of a wheel district, as I call them. So we've sort of reached a point where the winner-take-all electoral system is being stretched to we're asking it to do things that it's not designed to do. Now, here's the real dilemma of democracy in the United States and our winner-take-all system. Let's say we were willing to contort all these districts and just do anything we have to make them more competitive. And we make a lot more districts so that they're won 51% to 49%. So now you have all these close races, right? Well, that means you've increased the number of voters who are voting for losers. And so you've increased, because in a winner-take-all system, if I win, you lose. That's how it works. So you've increased the number of voters who election after election are going to feel disenfranchised because they ended up without having a representative in the legislature. No taxation without representation. So what this points to is that with the winner-take-all system, you can have more competitive elections or you can have more representative elections, but you can't really have both. These two important democratic values are pitted against each other in a winner-take-all system. And that's where a proportional representation system enters in and really, you know, for the 21st century country we've become, is a much better match for the people here, for the demographics, and how people live. So with proportional representation, instead of electing one district seat at a time, just to use one example, you can take 10 of these seats and combine them all together into one district with 10 seats. And with proportional representation, all the seats are weighted equal to the same number of votes, instead of with a winner-take-all system, highest vote getter wins and the other and everyone else loses. So in a 10-seat district, if a political party gets 30% of the popular vote, instead of winning no representation as they do now, they win 3 out of 10 of those seats because you win representation in proportion to the percentage of the popular vote you receive. So 30% of the vote gets 30% of the seats. If you win 60% of the popular vote, you're going to get 6 out of 10 of these seats in a 10-seat district. And what this produces is multi-party democracy. as a result of using a method like this, now voters can look out there in the political landscape instead of being stuck in these one-party fiefdoms where they're really, in our current system, we don't really even have a two-party system because the frame of reference for most voters where they live is of a one-party stronghold where their lone choice really is to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates their district. Well, with proportional representation, just about every voter can look out there in the political landscape and see a party to the left, to the right, to the center that can speak more directly to who they are and their understanding of the issues and their concerns about policy. So as a result of that, voters feel like their vote counts more. You see voter turnout levels that are much higher. The election that we're about to have for the House of Representatives to elect, you know, our national legislature nationwide, we know with a great deal of certainty that the voter turnout is probably going to be about 36%, maybe 40% of eligible voters are going to turn out in this November's election. You know, appalling number when you consider the fact that then the majority party will win about half of that vote. It means you have legislative majorities that are being determined by maybe 15 to 20% of eligible voters in the United States. That's a big problem. It leads to gaps between what Americans want and what the Congress produces. Well, with proportional representation, typically you have voter turnout levels that are 80, 85, 90% of eligible voters turning out. Believe it or not, it is possible to have 90% of voters turning out. It happens in many of these countries quite often. And more voters are voting for the parties that are in the legislature. And so the legislative majorities there truly are representing a majority of people instead of just a handful of voters as they are in the United States. So in many, many ways, there are just advantages of proportional representation over our winner-take-all system. More women win representation. You see countries where, you know, in the United States Congress right now, 14% of the seats are held by women. 14% of the seats are held by racial minorities, even though women are over a majority of our country and minorities are about 30% of our country. With proportional representation, countries like Germany and Sweden and what have you, you see women winning 30, 35, 40. Some of them, almost half of the legislative seats are being won by women today. And there's been studies showing that makes a qualitative and quantitative effect in terms of the bills that are introduced and the policies that are passed in those countries. So in just many, many ways, proportional representation is, I think, if I were to pick out of the 10 the most important of the reforms, that is the single most important reform that we could pass to really change the direction of our country.
All right. Direct election of the president.
Direct election of the president is, of course, many people have been talking about this for quite a few years, and the idea behind that is that we should have a nationwide popular vote for president instead of the Electoral College method that we have now. The Electoral College method that we have now is truly broken, and we've seen that in the last two presidential elections. Of course, in the 2000 presidential election, where the winner of the national popular vote actually lost the presidency, that was a pretty glaring example. But, you know, it actually almost happened in the 2004 presidential election as well. If just 60,000 voters in Ohio had changed their minds and voted for John Kerry, he would have won Ohio and the presidency, even though he still would have lost the national popular vote by 3 million votes. And if that had occurred, it would have made a lot of Republicans, I think, question the Electoral College system a lot more than they are. It tends to be something that's questioned more by people on the left side of the political aisle than the right. But the fact is, it's not working for anyone. And here's why. The last two presidential elections have boiled down to, you know, I mean, 6 months out from the election, people were looking at 10 battleground states. And the rest of the country, didn't matter whether you turned out to vote or not. Everybody knew who was going to win California, New York, Texas. Most states are just not competitive at all for one party or the other because they're, you know, it's not just that we have red versus blue congressional districts. We now have red and blue states, entire states that elect, you know, a Republican for president, Republican for two senators, Republican for governor, or Democrat, same way for all, all the statewide offices. But actually, as we got closer to the presidential election in both 2000 and 2004, those of us who really pay attention to these things, it was pretty obvious that, you know, 2-3 months out from the election, it was going to come down to two states, Ohio and Florida. You know, and you could just see that coming. And the 2008 election, we have every indication that it also is going to come down to two states, Ohio and Florida. So people who are wondering, can Hillary Clinton win the presidency in 2008, as some are, you know, I get that question a lot, I always say to them, ask yourself, can Hillary Clinton beat John McCain or Rudy Giuliani in Ohio? Because that's really what our national presidential election boils down to. Now, here's the interesting thing. It's not only just a handful of states, but if you're the candidates, you've got your polls and your focus groups that tell you that within Ohio and Florida, there's a whole bunch, you know, if you're the Democratic candidate, here's a whole bunch of voters over here who are never going to vote for you. They can't stand you. They hate the Democrats. They're never going to vote for you. And here's a whole bunch of voters over here who are absolutely going to vote for you, not because they necessarily even like you, but because they can't stand the other side. They, you know, I mean, so many voters today are voting by what we call negative consent. They're not necessarily voting for someone or for a party and what those the party believes. They're voting against the other side. You know, and the political consultants understand this. So they figure out who are the undecided voters in this important election. And that's who they focus all of their campaign solicitations to, their ads. You know, when the candidates go to those states, Ohio and Florida, and talk, their talking points are designed to solicit the vote from these undecided voters. So what this means is that, you know, a national election for president, where we should be having national debate and dialogue about the important issues of our times, really boil down to not only just a handful of states, but a handful of voters within those handful of states that are deciding our national presidential election. And this, in some ways, is truly the worst aspect of our system, where just voters are not being engaged, they're not being drawn into the political discussion because they simply live in the wrong place. And most voters are in that situation. They're on the political sidelines watching the presidential election from the 42nd row with binoculars. That's kind of what it's about. So if we had a national direct election for president, suddenly the entire country is in play. You know, whether you're living in red state Wyoming and there's only 500,000 people who live there in your tiny state, your vote counts as much as someone from blue state California. And you can't be taken for granted the way they are now. I mean, you know, voters in Wyoming or North Dakota or Montana or these red states, they don't get any more attention than blue state California or blue state New York. None of them get any attention. The only states that get attention are Ohio and Florida, really, and then a few of the other, you know, somewhat close races. So with a national direct election for president, more voters would suddenly count again, and it would engage our country on a level that we can't even imagine at this point to some degree. And there's actually an exciting effort right now underway to make this happen, because some people assume we need a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, but we actually don't. There's an effort called nationalpopularvote.com that is promoting this idea of taking the advantage of the ability of states to sign treaties with each other. And most people assume that we have a right to vote for president as an individual, but in fact, you do not. State legislatures constitutionally have a right to vote for president, and they decide whether to give that right to delegate it to individuals. In fact, in the 2000 presidential election, we saw the Florida state legislature that was threatening, if the recount went in favor of Al Gore, they were going to revoke the popular vote in Florida, and the state legislature, which was dominated by the Republicans, was going to determine the Electoral College vote in Florida. And so what this nationalpopularvote.com effort does is it says to the state legislatures, okay, we're going to ask you to sign a treaty with other states saying that you will give your states, 100% of your states' electoral votes, to the winner of the national popular vote. But it will only go into effect once enough states have signed on to this treaty that among those states, in aggregate, they have 270 or more electoral votes, which is what you need to win the presidential election. And once that number of states sign on, at that point the treaty goes into effect and the presidential election becomes a de facto national popular vote. To do this, it would take approximately 21 to 25 states signing on to this treaty, depending on the states, as compared to a constitutional amendment where you need two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the state legislatures. So it's a very clever idea. Bills have already been introduced into several states, and in fact, in California, the state legislature has passed this bill. It's sitting on Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's desk right at this moment, waiting for his signature. From what I hear, it's engendering a lot of discussion within the governor's office about whether to sign this bill or not. So I think we're going to see more talk about this over the next few years. It's an exciting effort. And I go into that in 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy in Step 5 about this nationalpopularvote.com effort.
All right. Unfortunately, we only have a few minutes to cover the rest of the territory of your book here. but talk about overhaul of the U.S. Senate.
Well, you know, the whole idea, and there's a lot to say about this, but I'll be brief. You know, the United States Senate is about the least representative legislative body in the world outside of Britain's House of Lords, and in part because of the unique representational structure where every state has the same number of senators regardless of population. So California, with 35 million people, has the same representation as Wyoming, with 500,000 people. Now, when our nation was founded and this structure was put in place, the most populous state had about 12 times the population of the smallest state. Now it's 70 times and growing. By 2030, to give you just one example, our four largest states, California, Texas, New York, and Florida, will have over a third of the nation's population. All four of them will no longer be white majority, and a couple of them may be approaching a Latino majority. And they're going to have the same representation in the United States as North Dakota, South Dakota, Idaho, and Wyoming, which together will have less than 1% of the nation's population. Already, we can see that senators representing about 18% of the nation's population can pass legislation, can kill legislation. So what I'm saying is that this is a demographic time bomb. It's a situation that is just built to blow. Increasingly, the United States Senate is going to be out of touch with the American people, with the priorities of the American people. It already is. I mean, studies have already shown that Congress is not on the same page as the American people most of the time in terms of the policy that comes out of the Congress at this point. But it's going to become worse. And because of this malapportionment of, you know, two senators per state regardless of population. And interestingly, it also is already leading to oddities in federal appropriation of tax dollars, where you can see that these low population states get far more federal appropriations per capita than the high population states. And so states like California, for every dollar we pay out in federal taxes, receives back about 80 cents on the dollar. And then a state like Wyoming, for every dollar it pays out, receives back, you know, like I forget the exact figure, but something like $1.30 per capita. And ironically, what it comes down to is that the blue states are subsidizing the red states, even as the red states tend to be the states that say, cut my taxes, get government off my back, I don't like big government, and yet they are totally being subsidized by the blue states. So this is just a schizophrenic aspect of American politics today that is being driven by the United States Senate and how unrepresentative it is.
Briefly, reform the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, as we've seen with the Supreme Court, I mean, it was kind of a fun chapter to write because I took the point of view in this chapter that, okay, after Bush v. Gore, the 2000 presidential election, what we saw is that the Supreme Court is really a legislature with 9 members on that legislature. And as we saw in Bush v. Gore, in terms of a legislature, 5 votes beats a reason any day in the Supreme Court. They don't need a reason for what they do. You know, these are supposed to be the greatest legal minds of our times, and in fact, in many ways, they reveal themselves to be every much a partisan hacks as Tom DeLay. And so, the point of view of the chapter is if it really is a legislature, let's treat it more like a legislature, and let's be not be so naive about, you know, some of the myths around the Supreme Court. So let's start doing things like term limits for Supreme Court justices. Part of the problem that's caused by the Supreme Court is that they have lifetime terms. You know, it used to be that Supreme Court justices were sort of elder statesmen, and of course they were always men and mostly still are. But they were appointed kind of at the end of their career as a capstone to a career in public service. They would serve, you know, 10 to 15 years maximum. Today the game is find some young buck who can be on there for 25 to 30 years, who has no paper record about what they actually believe, and then across the divide of the Senate Judiciary Committee, this little game goes on where, you know, you try to find out what they believe, they try to hide what they believe, and it's just very unsatisfying on many levels, including the political level. And it's all being driven by these lifetime appointments. So if we limit the terms to 15 to 18 years, that's still long enough that because the whole point of having lifetime terms was that we didn't want them to be affected by politics. Well, that's the term we also give to the Federal Reserve Board, who we also don't want to be affected by politics, some members of the Federal Reserve Board that determine interest rates and these sorts of things. And so, you know, I think we can do this for the Supreme Court as well. So term limits, multiple appointing authorities. Most other democracies, when they appoint their high court, it's not just the president appointing and then, say, a legislature like the Senate confirming. They have multiple appointing authorities or multiple confirming authorities. I mean, I already mentioned how unrepresentative the United States Senate is. So having that body confirming Supreme Court justices just builds into yet the third branch of government the same lack of representation that we have in the Senate. So you can look at the Supreme Court today and you can see out of 9 members, well, lo and behold, 7 of them are Republicans. So 7 out of 9, that's like, you know, nearly 80% of the Supreme Court are Republicans, and yet the United States is not 80% Republican. So it's not a representative body in terms of a legislature at all. And when we're calling people like Sandra Day O'Connor, who was Republican Speaker of the House in the Arizona State Legislature, appointed by Ronald Reagan, you look at a lot of her opinions, not very conservative, actually, and we're calling her a moderate on the Supreme Court, or when John Paul Stevens is being called a liberal on the Supreme Court, and you look at some of his opinions over the years, that's a good indication that the Supreme Court is extremely skewed towards one partisan side of the political aisle opposed to the other. So by having term limits, it would give more presidents the opportunity to appoint Supreme Court justices by having multiple appointing authorities and confirming authorities, and also having, instead of just a majority confirming a Supreme Court justice. I mean, when I looked at other nations around the world, you could see that they use thresholds like 60% or 2/3, and that means that you have to have more of a bipartisan selection. So these are the types of things that would really clean up the process and give us a Supreme Court that is more representative of the values and views of Americans from a legal standpoint.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're not going to have time to cover the other few points that we haven't gotten to yet. But in addition to your book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, what other resources do you recommend people to turn to?
Well, actually, at the end of each chapter, each step, you know, whether some of the other chapters that are in there, there's one on campaign finance reform, another one on media reform. At the end of each chapter, I have a list of organizations who are working on that particular reform. And so I highly recommend that people check out some of these organizations. You know, in media reform, there's great organizations working there. In campaign finance reform, organizations like Common Cause and Public Campaign, you know, instant runoff voting, Fair Vote, and my organization, the New America Foundation. So, you know, there's a number of good organizations that people should help out, because, you know, in order to fix our democracy, it's not going to happen overnight. And it's I know a lot of people are concerned about things like war, and those seem extremely pressing, and of course they are. But the fact is, I believe that at this point, all roads lead through electoral reform. If we don't fix our broken democracy, we're not going to ever get health care for the 46 million people who don't have it. We're not going to fix the pensions and Social Securities. I mean, you know, the social contract in this country that has existed since World War II is being shredded. And what's going to come next? No one really knows. If we don't have a functioning democracy where we can have that debate, it's what comes next is not going to be something that is good for our country. So in order to engage on all these other important bread and butter issues, life and death issues, we've got to fix our democracy. And that's what 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy is designed to do, is help us do that. There's a website for the book, www.10steps.net. That's 10steps.net. And I think by everybody doing a little bit, we can get the job done.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mike. I always appreciate it. You have a great show and a great station here. And I hope your listeners support you guys for years to come.
We've just been talking with Stephen Hill. He is author of the new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. And you can also check out his website, 10steps.net.